Well, I've enjoyed being with you these last few weeks, and tonight we have a daunting task in covering the 20th century and even into the 21st century a few years, and I was struggling with it, what exactly to include and what to leave out tonight, and so that's why your handout is a little bit thicker than normal. It has a number of charts and stuff there with you that will include at least some of the things I hope to get into, and even with that, we'll be doing a very cursory look at a lot of very important events. I want to give you kind of a broader view at first and talk about one major thing that happened in the 20th century that began in the 19th, which is the proliferation of Baptist denominations. You have a chart there, a little graph. It looks like this by Albert Warden, Baptist Around the World. He traces down different Baptist groups that developed, and there's a big split in 1845, which, of course, you know, because what happened in 1845? SBC began. This is when Baptist North and South split. So you had the major divide there between the Southern Baptist Convention on the right and the American Baptist on the left. And I kind of wanted to begin this in the 20th century because this is when most of the off splits began. Now, what happened after the North and South split in 1845? Well, for a while, these were pretty stable. American Baptists, those in the North, were mainly organized as societies, Society for Missions, Society for Literature, Society for Home Missions, but something else important happened in those years. National Baptists began. Freed slaves, black American, African Americans, they began to gather in churches, and they called themselves National Baptists. Their convention began in 1895, a little bit before the 20th century, but close enough for tonight. So in 1895, a major thing happened with National Baptist Convention forming. Now, one of the most amazing things to me of grace is that freed slaves who had been oppressed for centuries by white Baptist slaveholders nonetheless formed their own Baptist churches. I would have thought they would have been anything but Baptist. Yeah? If you had been oppressed, enslaved by Baptists, would you want to follow that religion? Yet amazingly, the majority of blacks to this day, there are more National Baptists than there are any other denominational affiliation among African Americans. And so to this day, now that they proved they were Baptists by splintering. Okay? In 1915, they went into two groups. They became three in 1960, but all of them have the phrase National Baptist in their title. And so black Baptists in North America are found in the National Baptist conventions. And again, they're surprisingly large. There are millions of black Baptists, and there are tens of thousands of black Baptist churches. So that's a major grouping of Baptists. Now, one thing that I'm hopeful of is that as time goes on, there'll be less and less white churches and black churches, but more and more multicultural churches. But as of now, there's still a very strong division between the whites and the blacks. And the National Baptist is the Black Baptist Convention, and they begin in 1895. Now, if you look further to the left, the American Baptists, they formed a national convention in 1907. American Baptist Churches in the USA. That was their denominational time. Now, they had been in societies before, but they saw the value of a convention structure. And from 1907 onward, they began to experience some problems. They began to drift ever increasingly leftward in their theology and their practices. In 1922, a number of conservatives within them recognized the danger, and they proposed adopting a statement of faith, the New Hampshire Baptist Confession, as would be their... Well, they turned it down. They said, we don't want any statement of faith. And so they said, well, New Testament is sufficient as a statement of faith. Well, that sounds good until you recognize that folks can say they believe the New Testament and they have a surprising variety of views. Well, they fought for a while, the conservatives among them, but then they began to depart. The GARB, General Association of Regular Baptists, in 1932, and they splintered off there. And then the Conservative Baptist Association, 1947, those two groups left. They were the more conservative. And today, American Baptists are by and large a moderate, mainline, a moderate to liberal denomination. I had the chance to be involved with an American Baptist church for a while during my seminary days, and the literature is surprisingly bad. If you think Lifeway is bad, there is worse stuff out there, theologically heterodox stuff out there. And they have become a traditional, mainline, moderate denomination, very little impact. And so those groups that splintered off from them did so because they were going too far left. On the right-hand side, Southern Baptists, they also suffered some minor splinter groups off. You can see them stretching down beyond their World Baptist Fellowship, General Association, Reformed Baptists, things like that. These were two major groups, fundamentalists, who thought the SBC was too liberal, okay? They thought that we were too liberal in 1920, yeah? There was a fundamentalist modernist controversy at that time. And J. Frank Norris, a fundamentalist in Fort Worth, Texas, kind of riled things up and gave people suspicious of Southern Baptist institutions, seminaries, things like that. So there were some smaller groups that split off. And then there were some Calvinistic groups that split off. As we began to move away from our Calvinistic roots, toward a more Arminian understanding, there were some small splinters there, but no major defections, nothing nearly as large as what happened in the American Baptist life. Well, I just want to make you aware of the breadth of different groups, and you can see across the bottom today, there are dozens of varieties of Baptists in North America alone. Well, I want you to at least be aware of that. Now I'm going to focus now on what happened to the SBC in the 20th century. And by and large, the SBC prospered in most areas, in most ways, in the 20th century. We had tremendous numerical growth. Our different major ministries all thrived. The IMB, again then called the Foreign Missionary Board, it grew into the largest Protestant missionary agency in the world. Okay? Today, more than 5,000 missionaries, and one respected by those outside SBC circles. When I was in the 1980s, I was considering being a missionary. I went to a very respected missiologist, Ralph Winter, who is Presbyterian by his own background, but he's a very respected evangelical missiologist. I said, now I'm looking at different mission agencies. I looked at the IMB. I've looked at other groups like that. He said, well, if you were born and raised Southern Baptist, why would you look anywhere else? The IMB is one of the most progressive, cutting-edge mission groups in the world. Why would you even think about going anywhere else? Now, this is interesting because in most years, Baptists are somewhat late adopters, you know, slow to move. But he said the IMB, progressive, cutting-edge, innovative, things like that. So they have grown. Now, right now, they're in a very important area because they've been without a president for a number of months. Now, there's a search committee. It's kind of divided as to which way to go. And so they're looking at that. So that's going to have an important impact. But for the last 20 years, the major focus of the IMB has been unreached people groups. And they have made tremendous progress in getting our focus off of traditional mission fields into the more unreached areas. So a very positive century for the IMB. North American Mission Board, a couple of things helped them along the way here. Again, we mentioned that in the early years there was confusion. Why do we even need a home mission board? Local associations, state conventions, they can handle things. But in the mid-20th century, we kind of made a change of policy from staying in the South to going into all the country. So now they had a much larger mission field. All those northern, western, midwestern states, they were now fair game for mission projects. And by 1964, we had SBC churches in all 50 states. Now, very weak in some areas, but at least there were a few there. That was a positive thing. They were very good in language mission, the home mission board, the North American Mission Board. Southern Baptist, this morning, we worship in more than 100 languages in this country alone. We have Southern Baptist churches that worship in Korean, Spanish, Russian. I can't name 100 languages, but we have them, okay? And we have been very good at finding immigrant groups and having someone that speaks their language to minister to them, start churches among them. That's been very, very positive. But then something else they began that has become problematic. For example, you're in Alabama, And you want to have someone working in Birmingham in a new church plant. Now, if you're the Alabama Baptist, maybe you can raise some money for that position, but not all. Oh, Home Mission Board says, well, we'll come alongside you and give half that guy's support. So they move from doing their own mission work exclusively to having lots of money tied up in what were called cooperative agreements. So this guy supports half state convention and half North American Mission Board. Now, the states that could do that the most were strong states. Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Texas, North Carolina. Well, those are not the most needy areas in the country. And so state conventions love the Home Mission Board. Now they will partner with us. They will help us do work in our state. But they began to lose the focus on the harder areas. More of their money began to be sucked back into the traditional South, which is a problem we've begun to address only very recently. But that did make them a lot of friends in state conventions. So foreign missions, home missions, how about literature or Lifeway? Again, they began not just publishing literature, but promoting Sunday school, not just as the teaching arm of the church, but the reaching arm of the church. And for most of the 20th century, church growth strategy focused on reaching people through the Sunday school. And that proved effective in many areas. And so the Sunday school board was very popular there, very focused on reaching people, things like that. And they began to expand beyond Sunday school literature to vacation Bible school literature, hymnals, Bibles, and other resources. Only very recently, publishing academic books for seminary students and things like that. A much better record in the last 10 years than ever before. And so now they are Lifeway resources, okay? Not just literature anymore, Sunday school literature, but a wide variety of things. And again, they seem to be in good hands, moving in good areas, things like that. They have their own zip code in Nashville. The largest publisher of religious stuff, at least in the U.S., if not in the world. Massive agency there. So they were healthy. So we did foreign missions, home missions, literature. Fourth major ministry the SBC does is what? Theological education. Yeah. So in the 20th century, and that when it began, we had one seminary, Southern in Louisville. But in 1908, Texas Baptists say we want our own seminary. They formed Southwestern. Initially, it was supported by Texas Baptists, but a little bit later on, the SBC kind of adopted it. We'll talk more about that when we talk about the cooperative program. And then Louisiana Baptists in 1970, they formed initially a college that grew into New Orleans Baptist Theological. And again, for a while, supported by Louisiana Baptists, but again, in 1925, it was adopted by the convention as a whole. And then fourth, Golden Gate, formed by California Baptists in 1944. And again, in a few years, adopted by the SBC. It's interesting that state conventions were always eager to form seminaries, SBC a little bit more reluctant to adopt them, until 1950. And then they realized, our folks want more seminaries. And so right here, in Wake Forest, there was a college, had nice facilities there, and they were planning to move to Winston-Salem. There's a nice campus there, facilities there, and they bought that from Wake Forest College to be Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. And so this is our 60th anniversary this very year. You may have seen a couple of spreads in the North Raleigh newspaper, things like that. We were the fifth, and then finally in 1957, they realized there was one gap in the Midwest, and so they formed Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in 1957. And I said that the first four, again, Southern, Southwestern, New Orleans, they were all formed by individual state, but something very important happened in 1925. We had this thing called the Cooperative Program. And seminaries can now be funded not by going out and shaking the bushes, but being part of a cooperative, unified giving plan. And that's when Southern and Southwestern and New Orleans were all adopted by the SBC, and they had a little slice of that cooperative program pie. And so 26 was a very big one. And today, Southern, Southwestern, and Southeastern are among the 10 largest seminaries in the U.S. We have three of the top 10 just in our system. And Southwestern has for a long time been by far the largest. Their lead is shrinking as Southern has grown, some others. But by all say, Southern have a lot of folks involved in theological education. Very important ministry that began in the 20th century and became the center of a controversy a little bit later on. In addition to those things, there were three additional agencies that deserve mention for their importance in the 20th century. Guidestone Financial Services used to be called the Annuity Board. They're the agency that manages retirement funds for Southern Baptist pastors, staff workers, things like that. These are the folks that know stocks and bonds and things like that, do a much better job than I could do in managing them. So I think every church should be making a contribution to Guidestone on behalf of their pastor. Okay? And again, the younger you start, the more the thing compounds and things like that and begins to grow. So very, very useful. Now, they're now opening their services to groups like Focus on the Family and Campus Crusade for Christ. So they're being utilized by other evangelical groups, but they were formed by and for Southern Baptists. The Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission was originally the Christian Life Commission. It was formed to address ethical issues, things like early on temperance, alcohol abuse, things like that. They were the one agency to be the first and last to protest racism in the SBC in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. But they began to run afoul of the SBC because in the 80s, they began to support in a somewhat covert way, but there was no strong pro-life message from them. They were more pro-choice, and so the SBC would pass resolutions in their conventions supporting the pro-life movement. They would get no help from their own Christian Life Commission. And so they, too, were part of the controversy that bubbled over later on. And also, for years, we had been involved with a thing called the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs. This was an agency of different types, American Baptist, National Baptist, Southern Baptist. They gathered. They had an office in Washington, D.C., to address First Amendment concerns, religious liberty concerns. The SBC supplied about 80% of their budget. But we found them increasingly being at odds with us on the issue we thought were important in First Amendment cases. Things like supporting the rights of religious groups in the public arena. And so we gradually withdrew from them, and we gave to the Christian Life Commission, again, that assignment for religious liberty, and that's when they changed into Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And that's where we still have an office both in Washington and in Nashville to address those issues. And Richard Lamb has been at the head there for a number of years. So we have Annuity Board, we have this thing, this commission, and then one last thing, the WMU. Any ladies here were involved in a WMU, either here or another church? Any WMU veterans out there? One? Only one? Well, again, this is something of the signs of the times. It was formed in 1888 by Virginia Baptist women at the instigation of Lottie Moon, okay, as a mission support agency within the churches. Again, they have served for more than a century now, being a very strong supporter of missions, both national home missions and foreign missions. And missionaries, even to they have no better friend than the WMU. One thing that they supply is they keep a list of missionary residences. Now, think about this. If you're a missionary overseas, you come back for 6 months, 9 months, you can't bring all your furniture, all your dishes, all your stuff back with you. What will you do for 6 to 9? Well, the WMU keeps a list of missionary. There are a number of churches that keep a residence for missionaries. They're fully stocked. You know, linens, dishes, pots and pans, appliances, all those things. So you can just move in with your clothes and live there for a while. Now the churches that have those, they become booked a year, 2 years, 3 years in advance. Because with 5,000 missionaries coming in periodically, you need a good number of those residences to house them all. And so this is one ministry that WMU carries on. It's a great blessing to missionaries. They still supply a lot of prayer support for missionaries. But they have undergone an identity crisis in the last couple of decades, where they're increasingly seen as being somewhat passé. More traditional churches still have them, but they've not succeeded in capturing the under 50 generation to carry them on. So they're graying, becoming less vital. Although I still think there needs to be some organization that keeps missions in the forefront. But they did develop. They were an important part for most of the 20th century. So for most things, we prospered. We grew tremendously in terms of numbers of churches, numbers of missionaries, things like that. But there were things brewing up that were not totally healthy during those years as well. That leads us to the two major controversies that we have encountered, one that we have somewhat concluded, the other just beginning. Let me talk about the conservative resurgence. Now again, this is something I lived through for most of you. It may be something very, very vaguely in your mind, but here's what happened. Throughout the 20th century, as we expanded our seminaries, we began to move up in the world, things like that. There were at least some that began to say, we want to be like the Princetons and Harvards and Yales of the world. We want to be academically respectable. And so we began to have folks coming into our seminaries who had those ideas. Now, if you remember last week, when Crawford Toy had those ideas at Southern, he got asked to leave. But in the 20th century, they signed the same statement of faith, but they began to interpret it much more elastically. So increasingly, a variety of theological views began to be accepted within our seminaries. Okay, and there were those that began to have uneasiness about this. The first kind of real bomb that came out was Ralph Elliott in 1961 published a commentary on Genesis. A professor at Midwestern Seminary. He published it through our own publishing house, Broadman Press. And when it came out, it caused a firestorm of controversy, because he was advocating the same things that got Toy fired 70 years earlier. And so they're saying, well, this can't be right. This guy's doing the same thing now that got folks fired back in the 19th century. But you guys had not made any move to fire him. Because, again, there was no protest at Midwestern. There was no movement by the faculty or the administration there to discipline this man. But others who read his commentary were very upset. And this was the reason why in 1963 we revised the Baptist Faith and Message to address the concern that we didn't have a strong enough issue or article on the Scriptures. So that they had a large committee. They revised the statement, but in fact, I think they weakened it rather than strengthened it. They said Scripture is a record of God's revelation. Not is God's revelation, but it's the record of revelation. Well, that's a phrase that Karl Barth could endorse. And they said the criterion by which the Bible is being interpreted is Jesus Christ. Yeah. Now, what does that mean? Well, for some folks, I mean, if I think that I have the spirit of Jesus in something, I can put that above what Paul said, what Peter said. I can have Jesus being my criterion. Well, they didn't intend it that way, but some took it that way. And so from 1960, when that statement was adopted, there was an uneasy truce for a while, but things didn't get better, and they got worse. A couple of examples. I was graduating from college in 1977. I was looking for a seminary to go to. A number of my friends were also looking. Some went to Southern. And they talked to folks. They said, now we come from a very conservative background. Would there be any faculty here, for example, that would believe that Moses had a large part in writing the first five books? They laughed at, "We're not a Bible college. We're a theological seminary. We don't hold old views like that." I had a friend that went here to Southeastern. Within a year, he had left the faith totally. He had professors that doubted the miracles of Christ, that doubted the truthfulness of Scripture, things like that. He was all shook about it. I actually heard a professor here saying, you don't have to believe that Jesus walked on water to believe in the authority of the Bible. We had an interim professor come to my church from Southeastern, a professor of New Testament. I asked him, would you believe, for example, that Paul wrote the pastoral epistles? Well, that's a matter of the evidence there. Well, how about hell? Do you believe in hell? Well, I mean, if someone wants to go to hell, God would allow them to go to hell. Not a very clear statement there. Now, these are the type of people teaching at places like Southeastern and Southern, less so at Southwestern or New Orleans, but there were some suspicions out there. And finally, some people got together in 1979 and developed a plan. Paul Pressler, Paige Patterson, among others, began to look at how could they possibly begin to move things. They didn't believe that Southern Baptists would support ideas like that if they knew about them. But how could they make people aware of these things? And then how could they shift the levers of power in the convention to change? Well, if you look at the second diagram, this organizational chart, let me walk you through the controversy by means of asking five questions and using that chart to explain. First of all, what was the controversy? Well, it was an open plan. There was no secret. They said, we want to change the direction of the SBC by doing this. Now, one thing that happens at every SBC meeting, they elect a president. So you see the first thing, the actual messengers elect a president by simple popular ballot. Now, the president is largely a ceremonial position, but he does have one very important power. He appoints this thing called the Committee on Committees. Now, only Baptists could have a committee on committees, but it's a very, very important committee. And the president appoints it unilaterally. No one can second guess him. No one can object to that. He appoints it. Now, that committee then nominates a committee on nominations. Okay? Now, that one has to be approved by the SBC. That committee on nominations, this is where the real action happens, because they nominate trustees to all our agencies. And trustees are the group that can change things. My boss at the seminary, my immediate boss is the president, but his boss is the trustees. The trustees hire and fire professors. They hire and fire presidents, administrators. They're the ones that can clean house. They're given that authority by the SBC. The convention owns the seminary. The trustees manage it on behalf of the seminary. Now they said, how can we get trustees on these different boards that are committed to changing things? They said, well, if we elect a president committed to change, he appoints this committee on committee. Those are folks are also committed to change. And they nominate the committee on nomination, people committed to change. And then about trustees committed to change. If we do that for a number of years, we can get people committed to change on these different trustee boards. And so in 1979, they elect Adrian Rogers president of the SBC. In 1980, his committee on committees meets. They nominate a committee on nominations. Well, they take office in 1981. And by 1982, they're making nominations for all the different boards. We have boards that control the IMB, North American Mission Board, Lifeway, Annuity Board, all of our seminaries. They're all governed by trustees nominated each year at the convention. Now, they don't rotate the whole board off at once. Between a fourth and a fifth of the trustees rotate off every year. And so when you come on your first year, your class is one-fourth at most of the trustees. Well, we'll need to go two or three years until we have a majority on these different boards. And so this plan, depending upon every year, electing a president committed to change, who'll keep this process going, keep the pipeline moving, And if they can keep it in place for a number of years, they'll begin to have presidents and committees and nominations, and then finally boards of trustees composed of people committed to change. So Presser and Patterson, they went out across the country, in every state, who are folks out there who are fed up with the way things are going, who want to see change. They identified pastors, laymen, they had a database. Yeah. Because again, all these things, all these different committees, they had to represent all the different states that are parts of our convention. So that they had to, tonight, for example, the Committee on Committees, two from every cooperative state convention. We had at that time 35. And so he had to have at least two people from every of these states that would be part of this process, that were committed to change. And then they have to have this committee on nominations. Well, two from each state, a lay person as well. So one has to be a lay person. Well, who can be put on this committee that will be people committed to change? And then they nominate all these different boards, executive committee, IMB. Again, all of them are composed of folks from each of the different states. Well, they begin in 1979, and for a couple of years, no one thought very much of it. And so after they begin to work, if they do this, they can really succeed. They can actually change things. And the march woke up, those who had been occupying most of those seats of power, begin to recognize they could actually do something here. And that's when the controversy really heated up. Now, why would there be a controversy about this? Well, three reasons. First of all, some say no change is needed. Yeah. We're still basically a conservative convention, but we're open to progressive ideas. And that's where the seminaries are. And we have some progressive people there. But they would say, well, we're still primarily a conservative convention. Well, if you have the whole spectrum, yeah. They're not just on the conservative half of the spectrum. They're on the conservative fourth of the spectrum, okay? And their faculties were increasingly not representative of Southern Baptist as a whole. Okay. And so some said there's no need for this change. I said, yes, there is need. Our seminaries are not representative of who we are. Some say no change is needed. And some said change is urgently. Well, they clash. That's controversy. Some question the motives of those seeking change. They said, they say they're about theology, but really, they're just hungry for power. They just hadn't been appointed any positions for a while, and they feel left out, and they really want personal power. And so they question the motives of those. And every year, for most of the controversy, they said, the real issue is not theology, it's power. And then a third thing were the means being used. The means on both sides were hardball politics. There were negative advertising about your opponents, not being very charitable, not being very Christ-like on both sides. Half-truths, innuendo, character assassination. There were some good people that had their characters besmirched. And this is one of the reasons why it was so painful, because so many people got hurt. They felt mischaracterized. Things. Now, on both sides, I was at some kind of conventions during the 80s where the tension was as thick as any. You could feel the animosity in the air between these fellow Baptists saying horrible things about each other. So some that I think were in favor of change didn't vote for it because they were repulsed by the means being used. Hardball politics, things like that. Why would this cause controversy? Well, again, some say there's no need, motives, means. Well, why did the conservatives win? Because we did. They elected every single year. Now, sometimes the convention's got 45,000 messengers, and the winning margin was hundreds of votes for the conservative candidate. Yeah. But they always managed to win. Well, why they win? Because we're overwhelmingly a conservative denomination. Nancy Emory, a sociologist at Emory, she did a survey. A good slice cross-section of Southern Baptists, large and small, rural, urban, all across a valid survey. She found that on the far right, there's about 20% that are, you know, really ultra right wing conservative. They think the SBC is almost beyond saving. And then there's a large group, about 50%, that are conservative in their theology. And then they're conservative, but they love peace. Basically saying that there's 83% overwhelmingly out of step with where the seminaries are. Well, this movement found a way to mobilize them, tap into their frustration at what they were seeing coming from their seminaries. Willing lay people, willing to take a day off their work to travel all night to a convention, stay there, vote for a president, and then take a long drive back home. Well, they were able to do that. And then this is in spite of the fact that the convention overwhelmingly is most represented by large urban churches that can afford to send their pastors there. Yeah. All those little mountain churches, they don't have the money for plane fare to send their pastors to a convention. So they're always underrepresented. And yet, even with that disadvantage, they always won. And so they began to get majorities on the boards of trustees. And about 1986 or 87, it happened at Southeastern. There was now a board of trustees that said to the president, going to be some changes here. Well, he resigned, the dean resigned, many faculty resigned, because they knew they could not deal with this board, because they were going to insist that people lived up to what they signed. They had been signing a statement and teaching contrary to it by any fair interpretation, and they were now realizing there were going to be some changes made. And over the next 10 years, from about 1987 to 97, it swept across the convention. And what have the results been thus far? Well, remarkable. When I was in a pastor in during the 1980s, my wife said once, wouldn't it be fun something if we came back here and you were able to teach the Southeastern? They would never want me. Yeah. Remarkable change in the last 20 years. In terms of when people who graduated from here in the 60s and said, when they come back now, they're amazed. There's often they will be in chapel with tears in their eyes, seeing what God has done here. So it was not just Southeastern, though, Southern. All across the board, there were new presidents in all the seminaries. The IMB, there was some concern there that they had let some missionaries go with them that were not particularly sound. They were again called again to account. The Christian Life Commission no longer were in support of abortion. They were in a pro-life position, things like that. All the agencies, basically, remarkable changes in the overall perspective. One thing that amazes me every year is the number of Southern Baptist Seminary professors speaking at the Evangelical Theological Society meeting. Yeah. We have a huge presence there that was not true prior to 1979. So, remarkable changes there. Last question, what are the prospects for the future? Well, we're now theologically sound, but we're now confronting a second problem that began to be noticed in the 80s and 90s, and that was a leveling off of our growth, and now the last 2 years, even small declines in the numbers of Southern Baptists. Well, that's been a great concern to many, and that has prompted the second controversy, the Great Commission resurgence. Now, you're living in the epicenter of that resurgence, okay? Because Dr. Aiken has been perhaps the foremost person pushing that agenda, saying that we want to focus ourselves back on the Great Commission, reaching people for Christ, things like that. And here's where they began to notice a variety of problems. Well, first of all, they said, obviously, it's taking more and more Southern Baptists to win one person to Christ. So our churches are not doing a great job there. And one of the problems there has been churches that are filled with half nominal, half unconverted church members. We need to focus on regenerate church membership, things like that. We need them to live a radical Christian life, things like that. Churches become healthy and holy. And then also they begin to look at the overall convention structure of funding. And say, somehow we're not getting the resources where they're most needed. And that led to a reexamination of the cooperative program. So I'll talk for a minute about the cooperative program. And again, you can still use this organizational chart. Because I will now trace how the money comes. Now again, prior to 1925, all of our missionaries, all of our agencies, they went out beating the bushes, trying to raise their own funds. And quite often, they would be competing at the same churches for missionary funds, for seminary funds. Well, this is not a good thing. In 1925, we came up with the idea of having a unified giving plan that will cover all the bases. So here's how it happens. A local person gives to their local church. Up here you have a little local church here.
Yeah.
So you give to your local church. Local churches are encouraged to give a percentage to the cooperative program. Well, not really to it, but through it.
Yeah.
Now, they encourage churches to give 10%. Let's say, if you want to set an example for your people, you ask them to tithe, you should tithe. Okay? So give 10% outside of your own causes. It goes first of all to the local state office in North Carolina. That's in Cary. And they say, the first ones who look at the money there are the local states. So they say, what do we need to keep of this money in the state of North Carolina? And again, you have also, I think, a little example of the program, the budget for the North Carolina Baptist. That's one of those little graphs you have there.
Yeah.
You see that? You have that on the back of that sheet there? You can see it showed to them there? Yeah. So that's what, the numbers is the other one. So, that's just what they actually spend. So there's things like for colleges, Mars Hill, Wingate, Gardner, Webb, there's Baptist children's homes. There's evangelism in North Carolina, church starts, things like that. So do a variety. Now, it goes first of all to the state, and then what they don't keep goes to the national level. That's where we do foreign missions, home missions, and theological education. And so every state is free to say how much they want to keep in their state and how much they give to the national level. Now, this began in 1925, and it does have some strengths. There are some positives. It's very economic as a fundraising mechanism. You're not spending money. People are visiting every church they're trying to get. We got 40,000 churches, you know. Reaching them all with a speaker would be very, very difficult. So it's strong there. It allows a church to be involved in all that we're doing. They give one check. It covers everything their state convention is doing. It contributes to foreign missions, home missions. It covers everything.
Yeah.
So for a small church who has a volunteer treasurer, writing one check, very, very convenient. Okay. It allows for folks to thoughtfully distribute funds. So it's not the most spectacular needs get the most money. Because if I think about, how can we best use this money strategically? And so that's good. It avoids having fundraisers constantly hassling churches. So churches like that. So this was a great boon to Southern. It began to work wonderfully well and began to fund all of our ministries much more economically. Now, we went through a tough time during the Depression, as everyone did. But post-World War II, this thing worked like a charm. There was money to fund all of the folks who wanted to go overseas on missionaries, funds for seminaries to expand, all very, very good stuff. But again, began recognizing a problem in the last 20 years or so. And there's one problem. It is nameless and impersonal, yeah. And folks like giving to what they can see, yeah. Put a face on it. And it also, because you're going to this shotgun approach, there's room for dissatisfaction. If you don't like what your state is doing, but you like what we're doing nationally, well, you resent the money that stays in the state. If you like what you're doing in your state, but you don't like what's going on nationally, you're dissatisfied about the money going to the national level. So there's room for dissatisfaction there because it's not directed and focused. But by far the biggest weakness is that far too much money stayed in the states. Now, right now, the split in North Carolina is 66-34. Who do you guess gets the 66? North Carolina. Now, isn't that backwards? Yeah. We get 66% of our mission money to stay in North Carolina, 34% for the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Isn't that backwards?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? You know, we have 4,000 churches already in North Carolina, and they're in pretty good shape to reach North Carolinians. Why do we need the bulk of missions money staying in North Carolina? Well, one thing is we have all these agencies. We have 6 Baptist colleges. And we have retirement homes and children. Well, institutions eat money. They need it regularly, okay? Now, one very positive thing happened a couple of years ago. We now have an agreement to disengage with the Baptist colleges. Because, again, they didn't want us choosing their trustees. They wanted to choose their own trustees. And they were willing to give up the money that we're giving them in exchange for their own. They were afraid that what happens to the seminary might happen to them. Yeah? That these Baptist colleges, which are Baptist in name only, yeah? They're not serving the kingdom very well. Yeah? In almost all these colleges, the most liberal department is always the religion department. Yeah. And so they're not serving the kingdom very well. And so we make, now you'll notice that there's a decreasing amount going to those colleges. And they'll eventually be getting nothing. Now, that will free a lot of money to go outside North Carolina. We need to. And so it's been proposed recently in this Great Commission resurgence is that, first of all, for individual Christians to give more, because the average Christian gives 2.5% of their income. So there's some room for growth there. And then for churches to give a higher proportion to the corporate program. Most churches don't give 10% for various reasons. That they want to expand their own ministries locally. They're growing, and they don't like what's going on in their states, and so they want to create a more to be put into the pipeline, and then for states to begin moving more of their funds, not keeping it for their own state, but giving more for the rest of the world, and then on the national level, North American Mission Board quit helping folks in Texas and Alabama. Started helping folks in New York and Chicago and L.A. Because, again, they're saying, quit making those cooperative agreements that keep so much of your money in our traditionally strong states. Focus more of the money in the traditionally weak states. Well, no agency likes to lose money. Okay? So when they made that proposal, there was some pretty strong opposition by state convention in Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, they wanted to keep the money. And there's, well, that's not where it's most needed. Yeah. So there's some movement going on. And you can notice, if you notice in the case of North Carolina, that we have moved. We used to keep 68% here. We're down to 66, okay? And we're moving in the right direction, but we're doing so more slowly than I would like. Now, there are 4 different options that North Carolina Baptist, that's the last chart there on the back there. If you look, there are 4 options you can give in North Carolina. You can give one option where only half goes to North Carolina. Now, not all the rest goes to the national. It goes to different causes within the state, Fruitland Institute, Bible Institute, some state missions causes, things like that. So you can make it a little bit less North Carolina, but nothing yet really moves half the money or more to the national level. Well, I think that's the direction we need to go. Now, that will only happen if churches like this elect and send messengers to state conventions. Now, deadly boring, yeah? But getting involved there is where you can vote on the next year's budget and say, why can't we give more money to the rest of the world? We got 4,000 churches to do the job in North Carolina. What do they have in New York City to do the job there? Not quite as many. So there, or Chicago, or Las Vegas, or Detroit, or those large, well, that's where people are moving to, and that's where we're the weakest. Why not put more money? Well, they won't do that unless local churches rise up and say, this is crazy, this is stupid, yeah? Keeping 2/3 of our money in this state and 1/3 for the rest of the world? Yeah. That needs to be reversed. Yeah. Now, I don't want to do that suddenly because, again, agencies, they're not equipped to take sudden losses in their budget, okay? But I think we could gradually begin to recognize more the need is out there, more than it's in here. And depend upon churches here to do their job locally and send the money, we can send people globally where the need is greater there. Well, this is at least something of what happened in the 20th century. We're still in the midst of the second controversy, but I want to leave at least some time for questions. We're a little bit over time, but any questions about what happened in the 20th century? Any of these charts and stuff? Give me a lot of information here to digest. Yeah. That is when you have someone who is retired, a pastor, who's living on a very small retirement fund. Churches can adopt them and help them out, support them, and give them a little bit more income. Because quite often, pastors were not wise. They didn't give very much to the annuity board. And they have a very small retirement package to live on. So they're trying to help them out. Yeah. There are two, Virginia and Texas. And the reason is that in Virginia, and this is to credit Southeastern put most of the pastors into Virginia, and they didn't like the movement toward becoming more conservative. And so there was animosity there, and those who were conservative, they simply could not get the convention there to budge on funding stuff outside the borders of Virginia. So they formed their own convention. And that convention gives more than half of its money to the national level. Same thing happened in Texas. There was an entrenched bureaucracy there that were in opposition to the seminaries, the changes that happened in the 80s and 90s. And they even defunded the seminaries for becoming too conservative. So conservative churches in Texas, they formed their own convention, and now they give more than half of their money to the national level. They don't see as much they need to do in Texas as they need to do outside Texas. So this has been a blessing. And those two, now, there's a sad thing of having two Southern Baptist conventions in a state. But in those two states, the situation was so serious, the opposition so the division so strong, that they couldn't walk together. We have not yet reached that in North Carolina. And I don't think we will. Because if I'm reading, in the last 5 years, there have been movements toward the right there, toward more conservative. Just this very day, I read that the editor of the Biblical Recorder is resigning because he's being pressured to become more conservative and give more attention to Southeastern Seminary and things like that, things that are going well here. Well, he is more of a moderate himself, so he's resigned. Yeah, but there's at least some pressure, some movement toward making this state a more conservative state convention. It, too, had a lot of pastors that, again, were educated by Southeastern. So we've had to overcome that. And now we've had about 20 years of putting good pastors into North Carolina churches, and we're beginning to turn the tide in this state convention.
Yeah. Dr. Hannah, I know that Southern Baptists weren't the only denomination to experience some theological drift. Yeah. Can you say a few words about why you think Southern Baptists were able to turn the ship where maybe other denominations weren't?
It's a very interesting thing. I think it has to do largely with the fact that we elected a president from the grassroots churches. In most organizations, when they're hierarchical, the bureaucracy is self-sustaining. And so the synods, they would nominate folks for the General Assembly, things like that. So those who make policy are kind of a self-perpetuating organization. There's no way for the grassroots to recapture that. And so the way that Methodists and Presbyterians went, they went that way, at least in part, because there was no way for the grassroots to regain control of the hierarchy, okay? Because they were more of a hierarchical, non-democratic polity. In the SBC, there was a way that if you had some people who aroused them, gave them a way to change things, there was a mechanism there that we could actually change the levers of power in the SBC. I don't think that exists. And so for very conservative Methodists, they form a good news movement there. There's some conservative president of the PCA, things like that. But there was no way they could actually recapture the levers of power in their denominations. There are two vice presidents.
And is that still kind of happening?
No.
It's been conservative all
Well, again, in about 1993, those who were more modest, they withdrew to the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, CBF. And so they kind of gave up. They said, we can't win here. Might as well go ahead and form a convention that we can do things our way. And so there's another national called the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. And they have never been more than 5% the size of the SBC. They have not attracted a wide following there. And they're now stagnant or even declining. But those churches that would have pushed that agenda have now largely withdrawn.
And some of those churches were also given to both. Yeah.
Well, again, I think what they're reflecting is that within their congregations, there was some division there. Yeah. Of folks who saw what's happening and were supportive of more conservative movement. And those who said, they're being mean to my friends. Yeah, I know folks that were on the other side. Especially here in Wake Forest, for example. Yeah. They know folks who have been hurt by these nasty people, and so there have been some churches that want to give to both. Yeah.
So which plan is recommended by conservatives out of these plans?
Yeah. D is the one that was devised by conservatives recently to give less to North Carolina causes. Now, it's not yet 50-50. There were some that proposed that, but they didn't think that would pass. But the Plan D cuts back how much is given to North Carolina causes, and at least since mission causes within North Carolina, Fruitland as well is going giving at least 34 to the SBC. Yeah. Why do we give a lot to them? We're on a declining plan. We're going to eventually give them nothing, but we can't cut them off all at once. That would really cripple them. So if you look at the previous year, we're declining year by year, giving less to the colleges, and we're on a scale to eventually give them nothing. And they want to become independent of us. We say, that's great, but we're doing it stepwise, so it doesn't cripple them totally. Yeah, good. Well, there was some animosity between the board there and the convention, so I think there's something there that they're not convinced that board is operating things well and wisely. Yeah.
About some of that changeover. What's your perception on how, if any, that's changed over, say, the last 15 years?
No, I think it's changed a whole lot because, again, what happened initially was a lot of those who left Southeastern faculty, they simply retired to Wake Forest. Mm-hmm. They had their home. So they were close enough to just retire. So they were still here while things were changing at the seminary. Now, some did move on to the seminary in Richmond. There's a seminary there and other places. But a lot stayed here. A lot of the staff, they knew that these guys were nice people. They treated me nicely. Why are they being so awful to them? And so there were places where Southeastern was perceived as being a hostile takeover. I mean, these people were loved in the community, and they were nice people, and they were kind, and things like that. And here's these awful people treating them so horribly. And so you had people who saw the concern as the mean-spirited, nasty people that treated my friends so horribly. So for a while, it was really tense here. And then when Dr. Pastor was the president here, well, he was the lightning rod, you know. He was the public enemy number one for them. And here he is in their own backyard. So very difficult. Interesting little side note. When Dr. Pastor became president here, he made inquiries at Wake Forest Baptist, you know, which has a church on our campus, about joining there. They asked him not to. They thought that he would not be welcome in their church body. Okay, so to get an idea of someone turning down a membership opportunity. Well, so there was that. Now, when Dr. Aiken has just come, who cannot like Danny Aiken? Yeah, he's such a kind, loving, positive. So he's been able to, I think, mend some bridges. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, he spoke at Wake Forest Baptist. And they had a series of Wednesday evening services on controversial issues, and they asked him to speak on the controversy. And he spoke there, and again, was well received. So I think that as some of those folks, either they pass on, or their friends are no longer around here, or there's, the members are not quite as keen, as close to the surface. I think there's a healing where today, if you say you're a Southeastern student in the community, there's usually a more positive than negative reception there. That was not always the case. So I think it's changing. There may still be some individual pockets. And even Wake Forest Baptist, which has been a center of a lot of the opposition because a lot of the professors went there, even that has become more open to us. And the present pastor, he's not the same place we are, but he's a fair-minded guy who doesn't want to see that type of anger and stuff. So I think we're making progress in those areas.
Are there seminary students ministering now?
I don't know of any. There are members there. There may be some. I don't know where all the seminary students go. But by and large, that's not one of the churches that students go to, because, again, it's not on the same page as we are theologically. They would be a good bit more moderate. And so when I talk to students as to where they're going, I have not yet met a student that was going there. Okay? There may be some. I don't talk to all, but I've never not met a student who was going there. Okay? No, there's no law. Again, that's by popular election of the convention.
So it's possible we'll go through the other side of things.
Again, for that to happen, two things would have to happen. One, the grassroots would have to radically change. Yeah. And again, grassroots don't change very rapidly. Yeah. We are so overwhelmingly a conservative denomination. And it would take someone to arouse all the moderates in the convention, and there aren't that many, to come and vote. And if they elected someone like that one year, he would not be reelected the second year. Because they would recognize that, and they would organize and mobilize again. I don't think he'd have a chance for the second year reelection. Yeah.
You know, there's a big, conservative mindset, but is it such a hard thing to push people to change, to send more money internationally?
Yeah. That's a fascinating thing, and somewhat paradoxical. Again, I think we were able to change things on the national level because there were some really obvious things like seminaries that were liberal and things like agencies that were having problems. So we attacked the national problem. There has not been as much success on changing things on the state level. And I think one reason, maybe why, you got a lot of folks in North Carolina that are alumnus of Campbell, Gardner Webb, Cho Wan, those colleges like that. So they feel some loyalty to their alma mater. Yeah. And you got a lot of folks who's are involved in those types of things. So you have a lot of strength in Northern. And so those agencies seem to have a little bit more clout here. And so changing the, it's also very hard to change institutions. You can't defund them all of a sudden. They can't survive things like that. So what we're doing now is, I think, a good sign that we're beginning to change the ship of budgets. But budgets can't be radically reallocated overnight. So it's taken a while to recognize there's a huge problem here. This is crazy. Not as many people are aware of what's going on in their state conventions. If they were, I think they'd be a lot more troubled by it than they are. Yeah. And we're giving money, and two-thirds stays in North Carolina. One-third goes to the world. Well, obviously, that's crazy. Now there are two ways that people get around that. They give to a lot of Christmas offering, which goes all overseas. Or Annie Armstrong, that goes all North America. So there are ways that you can get your money where you want to go, focus in those ways. So maybe there hasn't been quite as much pressure to change the whole corporate program. And again, for a long time, corporate was a sacred cow. You don't touch that, you know. It's been so good to us, we don't want to change. Well, they actually made some comments about that, and they were thoroughly Dr. Aiken was very thoroughly criticized for that. But they are making some changes along the way there. But it was for a long time a sacred cow in Southern Baptist life.
Does the International Mission Board go to South America?
Oh, yeah, it's all over the world, yeah.
So there isn't another mission board for South America?
No, the International Mission, it covers the whole world, okay? Now, they're divided into different regions and stuff like that. So they have a region for South America, but that's internally. They're all part of the same mission board.